Good morning, and welcome to the KUNM Call-In Show. I'm Ed Williams, reporter for Public Health New Mexico. There are over 500 abandoned uranium mines on the Navajo Nation, left over from a uranium mining boom that lasted for four decades in New Mexico. Mining itself has stalled here, but many of the abandoned mines from the past are still posing serious health risks for people living nearby. But after so many years, where do cleanup efforts stand today? How are Navajo communities dealing with the pollution of their land? And what are authorities doing to fix the situation? With us this morning to talk about uranium contamination and the health and cultural risks it poses to Navajo communities are Edith Hood and Bertha Nez, both from the Redwater Pond Road community of the Navajo Nation, and Jordan Johnson, McKinley County Place Matters, who recently published a health impact assessment of uranium contamination in New Mexico. Thank you all for being here.
Thank you for having us.
The Environmental Protection Agency will be joining us on the phone later in the program to talk about cleanup programs. But communities near Church Rock have been hit especially hard by uranium pollution after a mining dam spilled radioactive waste into the environment there in 1979. And people living nearby have suffered health problems and even today are having to leave their homes while cleanup projects are going on. Bertha and Edith, you're from the Redwater Pond Road community, which is very close to the Church Rock disaster area. So tell us about your home. What was it like growing up in that area?
Okay. As children, we lived in the valley between what is now the abandoned sites of Kerr-McGee and UNC. And I remember when the exploratory drilling came in, and we did not know what they were doing, but they started drilling back in the 1960s before the mines came in. And that whole place was like our play area, and we did not know that they had come in to desecrate and contaminate the land.
And you were children when this exploratory drilling started?
Yes, we were actually right in the area when they started this. And as children, you know, we took care of our sheep. We herded sheep in those places, and we got to see firsthand what was happening.
Did the companies that came in to drill, were your parents, were your family, was your community aware of what was going on at that time? Did they tell you what this mining was going to be?
At the time, I did not know what was going on, and we stayed with our grandparents, and I really don't think they knew what was going on, or for anyone to come in, maybe from the tribal side, to tell us what will be taking place.
This is a question I think that is important. Can you talk a little bit about the importance of community in the Navajo culture and what home means for you?
Well, where we live, with the cultural, we have things that are sacred to us. And these people came in and they went through everything that was sacred to us. That we use plants or the land, so these were all disturbed when they came in. And at the time they came in, they never told us that there was contamination there from the mine, so we never knew what was going on. And we were just little kids then.
And nobody knew what's going on, is that true? Did the companies, did they hold any kinds of meetings with community leaders or people to, you know, ask what the importance of this land was to the community?
No, they never told us anything about the radiation. Just the mine came in and they started working.
And Jordan Johnson, can you tell us a little bit about who these mining companies were and how the permitting process took place? How did they get to this land that, you know, is on a Native American reservation?
I think from my understanding is that much of the Navajo Nation has rich natural resources. And so very early on in the I think 1800, there was a federal law passed around hard minerals, and so they had access to hard minerals, which uranium is a hard mineral. And so through the federal government, there's permitting process that they've went through, seek their permits, but also much of that land is multi-jurisdictional, so it crosses between county, private, and Navajo land.
Kind of a patchwork of land ownership.
Yeah,
I guess.
Call it the checkerboard.
The checkerboard.
So,
would the Navajo government have needed to give permission to these mining companies to come in?
They would have needed to give them permission and sign off for them to extract the uranium.
And Edith, you worked in the mines, didn't you, when that was going on? Can you talk a little bit about that?
I went to work at the Kermagee mine back in 1976, and I worked there for 6 years. And I was a probe technician, which is a person that detects the ore to see if it's high or low in grade. And I had to travel down 2,000 feet, and we had two levels of. There was a level 4, level 5, and I worked closely with the miners. And it was sort of up to me to tell them, go on with what you're doing, go another 6 feet. But if the ore grade was not high enough, we had to stop where it was and go to a different place.
Have you had any health problems from that experience of mining the ore? I know that a lot of people have, and that's kind of an ongoing issue when we talk about uranium mining. Is that something that you've experienced or that people you know have experienced?
Yes, I have. Back in 2006, I was diagnosed with lymphoma, and it had attacked my immune system, and I had to undergo chemotherapy. And from that, I think I started having, it was more like it started to affect my health from then on.
Well, I'm glad that you're okay and that you've made it through that. Now, the spill that happened in the Church Rock mine is kind of an infamous spill. I believe it was the worst release of radioactive materials that happened in American history. Is that accurate?
It's probably the second largest.
Worst or second largest?
Third Mile Island. But nobody really knows.
And tell us what happened. It was the failure of a piece of equipment, of a dam, right?
A dam broke. There was a crack and the dam broke, and it released over millions of radioactive material. So,
Edith and Bertha, do you remember that day when the spill took place at the mine? It was the mine that you worked at, wasn't it? Kermit mine.
This site was under the United Nuclear, UNC.
Okay.
And I did not hear of it till the next day. And, of course, I was working for the other site, Kermagee, and we did not hear about this till the next day.
Nobody knew that it had happened?
I think it happened early in the morning, 6 o'clock, when this happened, and from there on, I guess it just went washing down through the wash.
Washed into an arroyo, contaminated the drinking water. How did the community deal with that? How did you deal with it? How did your families deal with it? What was the reaction in the community when there was this massive spill of radioactive pollution?
We live a hill over where the dam broke. So people that live down by the dam, the arroyo, it washed through there. I guess people had livestock and that went into the water and they walk across. And yes, they had, those are the ones that had more problem with, and they lost some livestock, and the people that walked through the wash had effect on their legs and their rashes on, that's what I've heard down the arroyo.
And of course, Jordan, you wanted to say something?
Yeah, I just want to add too that when we were conducting our health impact assessment, we talked to many family members along the arroyo, and they had said it was like, what happened? It rained, and it didn't really rain. And so they noticed the significant amount of water that came rushing through the Puerco. And so I think it's important to understand that people were not adequately informed about what had taken place. Even though there was some talk in the community, there was not the significant amount of outreach needed in regards to the potential risk of what the material was going through the river.
Well, we want to hear from you. Has this issue affected you or someone you know? And what should the government be doing to fix the situation? You can call our local number, 277-5866, or toll free at 877-899-5866. Or you can send us an email at callinshow@kunm.org or post comments to our webpage. That's kunm.org. And of course, there was the disaster that happened in 1979. This is an ongoing issue, and it's affecting you guys today as the cleanup continues. Can you talk a little bit about what's going on even now with the cleanup process and how you're having to deal with it today?
I think for us at the residents of Redwater Pond, we had to deal with relocation. They have cleaned up a few spots in the community where people had to move out. And yet, you know, they're still talking about cleaning United Nuclear's mess and then, of course, Kerr McGee. And we're trying to tell them that to clean both places up at the same time. But for right now, only one is supposed to be cleaned up, and they're still talking about the other one across the way. So it's sort of stressful when you have to be moving out to town, to an apartment, to a rental, and yet you have to think about what's going on back home. And people with livestock, they have to think about those things. What's going to happen to us? And then, especially for the kids again, the children have to go to school. How are we going to get them to school? Things like that. The little things that may not be quite so concernable to, you know, the other population.
And so you're having to, while the cleanup efforts go on, you're having to leave your home and go to a motel in Gallup, or something like that, until it's safe to go back?
Yes. So far, we've had to move 3 times. And within that time, you know, we've been gone maybe 3 to 4 months while they clean up the mess. And it surprises me sometimes when they sample these grading and the ore, especially along a road. They say it's just a little bit. Here they were digging up at least 20 feet of dirt to remove all that.
Well, we're talking about uranium contamination on Navajo land with Edith Hood and Bertha Nez of Redwater Pond Road, Jordan Johnson of McKinley County Place Matters, and on the phone with us is Clancy Tinley, Regional Assistant Director for the EPA Superfund Division. We're going to take a short break here, and then we'll be right back to take your calls and speak to the EPA a little bit about cleanup efforts that are going on.
Edible Arrangements at 4770 Montgomery Boulevard Northeast in Albuquerque offers fresh fruit bouquets and chocolate-dipped fruit for any occasion. EdibleArrangements.com or 505-888-0100. Edible Arrangements is a valued supporter of KUNM.
The Vortex Theater presents Steve Martin's The Underpants, a comedy about the absurdity of instant fame. Starting June 19th, tickets at vortexabq.org or by calling 247-8600. The Vortex proudly supports KUNM.
On the next Audio Revolution,
In Between Two Worlds.
In Between Two Worlds.
This is Jacob Tafoya, and I'm here. My name is Jacob Tafoya, and I'm here at Youth Media Project at Warehouse 21. I just want to give you a little vision, a little view, my perspective. And this is my view of In Between Two Worlds. In Between Two Worlds. Here it goes.
Tune into Youth Media Project's Audio Revolution this Friday at 8 a.m.
on KUNM.
KUNM 89.9
FM.
This is KUNM 89.9, broadcasting from the University of New Mexico. I'm Ed Williams. We're back talking about abandoned uranium mines in the Navajo Nation and cleanup efforts that are going on there. Do you have questions about the history of uranium mining here or the health impacts it's had on our communities? If you want to weigh in or ask a question of our panel, the number is 277-5866 locally in Albuquerque, toll-free 877-899-5866. You can also send us a tweet at KUNM News. Well, joining us on the phone from California to talk about cleanup and what's going on federally to fix this problem of uranium contamination is Clancy Tinley, Assistant Director for the Superfund Division at EPA Region 9. Mr. Tinley, thank you for joining us this morning.
Thank you.
How would you characterize the problem of uranium contamination on the Navajo Nation?
Well, I certainly agree with the callers. It's an enormous problem. It's a tragedy. There have been impacts to the Navajo people that really go beyond words. And because of all of that, we take our responsibility to get the cleanup moving as fast as we can. We take that responsibility very seriously. Since 2008, EPA and five other federal agencies have joined together with the Navajo Nation to implement a five-year plan to address the worst problems. So during that time, we tore down 34 houses that were contaminated with radiation. We rebuilt new houses for those residents, provided safe drinking water to over 1,800 families that lived in mine-impacted areas but didn't have piped water. And we went out to 520 mines into the field to do screening level, the first level of assessment. And then we performed some cleanup work at 10 of the mines. So that's a good start. We know it's not nearly fast enough for the residents that were impacted. We're now working on our second five-year plan that goes from 2014 to 2018. And in this plan, we now have enforcement agreements and settlements with the responsible parties that conducted the mining, covering 83 of the mines, and we've done cleanup actions at 10 of the mines.
How many need to be reclaimed still? What's your time frame for getting folks like we have here in the studio back into their homes permanently?
Well, it's a very big job, and with 523 mines, what we're doing is we're focusing on the highest priority mines first. So there's 46 mines that are located that have highly elevated radiation and are located near home. So that's our top priority. So we expect to get out and conduct full assessments and conduct any urgent actions that are necessary at those 46 mines by 2018.
And help us on... Go ahead, I'm sorry.
Beyond that, for the remaining mines, it's a long process to take the next level of priority mines and assess them and start cleanup. And this type of project, typically looking at a project of this scale, this is more like a 20-year type time frame for getting a handle on the problem.
20-year time frame. Edith and Bertha, I mean, how do you deal with that kind of a time frame? What does that mean for you? Can you deal with the time frame that's that long, 20 years?
It is hard because they keep telling us we're going to do this at this time, and then they keep moving back to years back, and then they say they don't have certain things or laws and regulation they have to follow, and then we start try to get ready, but then it falls back on it. They keep saying that not at this time until maybe next 2-3 years. So it's a frustration.
Clancy Tinley, help us understand how this cleanup actually works. I mean, what are you doing to clean up, and why does it take so long?
Sure. So for the 20 years, I was referring just broadly to the overall scope of the problem. But at Northeast Church Rock, what we're doing right now is we're doing the design for the cleanup. So we've completed some scientific studies that told us whether it would be safe to move the mine waste over to where the United Nuclear Mill waste already exists. So we did borings into the mill waste to determine if it would be stable enough to take more mine waste on top of it. The results of those tests were good. So now we're in the design phase where we're designing a facility that will be able to last forever, that will never fail, and will never have another tragedy like we had in 73. So that's a 2 to 3 year process, and we're moving that as quickly as possible, and we're engaging experts from the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, the Department of Energy, and the Navajo Nation. Once that 2 to 3 year design phase is done, then it moves on to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, does additional safety and environmental reviews to double check to make sure everything will be safe forever, basically. And that process takes 2 to 5 years. And I completely agree that this is a very difficult time because it takes so long, but we want to do it right.
Well, for our listeners out there, what do you think about this long cleanup time frame? I mean, are we doing enough, and what more can we be doing as a state, as a community, to address this issue? If you want to weigh in or ask a question of our panel, the number is 277-5866 locally, toll-free 877-899-5866. Tweet to us at KUNM News. You can reach us as well by email at KUNM News. Clancy Tinley, the EPA just won a settlement against a mining company that's responsible for part of this pollution. Can you explain what that was and whether or not it's speeding up the time frame for cleaning this mess up?
Yes, this will be a significant boost to our efforts. So this was a settlement with Anadarko Petroleum over a nationwide series of problems, environmental problems that they had had. The EPA received $985 million, so almost $1 billion, to clean up 50 abandoned mines, 50 of the 523 abandoned mines on the Navajo Reservation. Those mines are former Kerr-McGee mines, so they're located in Cove, Arizona. The Kerr-McGee mine that Ms. Hood mentioned a moment ago, that one receives funding. And then just to the east of the Navajo Reservation in the Ambrosia Lake, New Mexico area, there's 18 mines there that can receive funding. So that will definitely accelerate our work for those 50 mines.
Well, Jordan Johnson, you recently published a health impact assessment of uranium contamination. And, you know, given the cleanup that's going on, maybe it'd be helpful to talk about a little of some of the findings that you were able to identify in your study.
Yes, so we did recently conduct a health impact assessment, and we looked at four primary health determinants. One was environmental contamination, pollution, relocation displacement, also cultural relevance of the land, and then community efficacy. And what we found through doing our research and what other studies have been published is many Navajo uranium workers are 3 times greater than the U.S. average to get lung cancer. And McKinley County has high rates of stomach, kidney, renal, and pelvis cancer. And Native Americans primarily are at higher rates of mortality because they were the primary workers in the mines. But it's not just people who are working in the mines. There's also what's called non-occupational risks. So family members were exposed to uranium contamination because they would come home, take their clothes off. Kids would play with the boots or the yellow dirt that they saw. And many, as Bertha and Edith mentioned, people would play in the water. And so the other piece is livestock was contaminated. So when they did bring their sheep down to get water, they would butcher their sheep, and they would notice that there was yellow material within the organs, and so they were just not really readily aware of what that was. Also, many workers drank the water as it came out of the walls and ate their food in the blast. And so there's many different ways that people were exposed to the dust, the contamination, without really knowing the risks that they were experiencing.
What do you mean drink the water out of the wells, out of wells that were contaminated for personal use on the properties? Or
so as Edith mentioned, they would be down under in the tunnels, and there would be water, from my understanding, water running down the tunnel sides. And so they were thirsty, and they would just put their hand out or get a cup get some water and drink it, because nobody told them that they couldn't or shouldn't drink that water.
And Clancy Tinley, how does the EPA take these kinds of health concerns into account while you're cleaning up? Because certainly in the process of cleaning, you're creating more potential health risks.
Well, we certainly do look at the studies that are ongoing. I think one of the studies that Jordan is talking about, it refers to that the closer you are to a uranium mine, the more likely you are to be exposed to the uranium and the radium and other potential health effects. So that's why we're focusing on cleaning up the mines that are closest to houses first.
Well, we have a caller on the line. Judy from Albuquerque has a question about the cleanup process. Hi, Judy. You're on the air.
Thank you very much. My question is, because I hear cleanup and Superfund cleanup, and my question is, where does the waste that is cleaned up go?
Thanks, Judy. Clancy, you want to take that?
Yeah, you bet. So for every individual mine, when we approach the cleanup, we go to the community first, and we talk to the community about what makes sense to them. And it varies from community to community. So, for example, up in the Monument Valley area, there was one mine that was on top of an 800-foot mesa, and the mine waste had been dumped over the edge of the cliff down to near where people lived. And we worked with that community, the Ojeto chapter, to figure out options, and their voice was, put it back, take it back to the top of that mesa and put it in something that will be safe forever. And so we did. We built a cable and took it all the way back to the top of that mesa. In other cases, there would be different solutions. So at Northeast Church Rock, there are three facilities. There's two mines and one former mill site, all located in the community, immediately in the community. The community told us, reduce the number if you can. So we were taking the one of the mines, the Northeast Church Rock mine, and moving it and consolidating it into the mill site. And then our next step will be to clean up the other remaining mine that's there. So, it's an individual decision for every individual mine, and we try our best to work with each community to do the cleanup that works the best for them.
How do you decide which is the priority mine to clean up? Is it just a matter of how bad the contamination is, or whether or not there's people, like our guests here in studio, that live in the vicinity of the mine?
People living near the mine is one of the biggest factors. So if we have elevated gamma radiation and people within a quarter of a mile, that's a high priority. Or if there's just slightly elevated radiation, but it's within 200 feet of a house, that makes it a priority. The third way a mine can become a priority if it affects water. So there are some mines in the Cove, Arizona area that affect the water in the Cove Wash, so that makes that a priority.
Edith and Bertha, what do you think needs to be done? What does your community think needs to be done beyond what's being done right now by the federal and tribal governments?
My thinking is that these agencies or these entities need to get together and start working on these problems and stop prolonging what needs to be done. Because of all this, we're trying to get these things, these contamination of water, air, so that our children, our grandchildren can grow up in a safe environment. That's what we want.
Clancy, I'm sure you hear this often. What's your reaction when you hear this kind of statement from people that live, that are affected personally by these mines?
Well, of course we agree. We'd like the cleanup to go as fast as possible. We do everything we can to work with all of the other federal agencies that can help and the tribal agencies that can help. We work with Navajo EPA, Navajo Abandoned Mine Lands Program. We have a strong team of people, and we're working as fast as we can. We certainly acknowledge this is a tragedy that should not have happened. It should have been fixed yesterday, but we're doing everything we can to move it quickly.
Well, it should have been fixed yesterday. Is this a matter of funding? I mean, you did get some money from a court settlement, but if there was more money, could this be going faster?
Work has accelerated very steadily since 2008, and we've been able to bring in private funding through enforcement actions. We have enforcement actions with General Electric and United Nuclear, with Chevron, with El Paso Natural Gas, with Freeport Mining, with BHP Billiton. I mean, we have large corporations that are responsible for the mining that have agreed under enforceable orders to do the work. So I think that funding is coming. I think it's just a very large task. It's a very difficult task when the mine waste is mingled within where people live, and it takes time to sort out the best way to fix that.
I see. Jordan, you wrote in the study, you had some things to say about this issue of funding and funding of the relocation and of infrastructure for the people that are being relocated by this process. Can you tell us a little bit about what your concerns in that area are?
Sure. So one of the things we're working with the Redwater Pond community is because they have to be relocated in the future for an extensive period of time, we would like to see them in housing that they want to be in. And so many of the community members have expressed being relocated up on top of a mesa instead of moving into town. Their family members used to have houses up there, and they grew up there, and it's close to their home. So we would like to get some funding, and we are in conversation with some of these entities around how to get electricity and water to the mesa, with US EPA about the potential of offering housing options to, if we can figure out how to get them on feasibility studies to get them on top of the mesa, which makes more sense so they are not placed in hotels or motels for seven or trailers for 7 to 10 years while the cleanup process goes. But it is a process, and it's not like we're living in an urban environment. There's home site lease that we have to think about, Navajo preservation land, and so the multi-jurisdictional issues come into play. And so it's a little bit more of a process than living in Albuquerque per se.
Living in Albuquerque. Now, Clancy Tinley, I assume that the EPA has limits on where its funding can be placed. Are you able to, where does your ability to give financial assistance to these families and people from the Navajo Nation that are affected end?
So what we're able to do is, just what the caller was saying, is when the mining creates such a disruption that people... it's not a good idea for them to live there during the cleanup. We're able to provide long-term temporary housing. And when we do that, we try to be as flexible as possible and provide a variety of options. We know people don't want to stay in a motel room for a year. You know, that's ridiculous. Nobody would want to do that. So we're working with the community very closely, explaining whatever options that there are. I know that we've heard that the community is interested in living on top of the mesa near that area, and that there are challenges there because there's no water or electricity. But we know the community is continuing to look for options to provide those. But we can build the housing, and it's our goal to try to find a solution that works best for everybody.
Living on top of the mesa, is that the mesa on Redwater Pond Road where you grew up, Edith?
I'm sorry. This is at least 3 miles north of where we're at, and it's up on the mesa. It never had electricity or running water or anything of that sort. So it's like building up from a new place.
Why is it important to you to live to have that as a place that you can live?
That's Eden. Where our grandparents used to live up there. See, like we used to go, there's summer camp and winter camp. We used to go up there. So that's why we want to keep that place. And after all the cleanup, we want to move back where we were too. So and then we're saying that maybe if we move up there, the mine might take over the land again. So we still want to stay within that place too. Because we got extra families that, you know, they're out. Going to school or in service, they come back and they want to move back.
So. Clancy, is there a possibility that this can never be fully remediated to the point that it was before the accident happened, or are you able to completely clean this area to the point that people can confidently live there without the fear of any kind of illness from contamination of uranium?
We're confident that we can make it a safe place to live. Where the Redwater Pond community does live now, we can clean that up to a standard that will be protective of living there, driving the car on the roads, using the plants, practicing traditional practices. We're confident that we can do that.
Well, you're listening to the KUNM Call-In Show live from the University of New Mexico. We're talking about uranium contamination on the Navajo Nation and the cultural, the health impacts, the spiritual impacts that that's had on people living there. Were you aware of the extent of uranium contamination on Navajo land? And what do you think this issue means for us in New Mexico as a state? If you want to weigh in on the conversation, the number is 277-KUNM. That's 277-5866 locally in Albuquerque. Toll free at 877-899-5866. Or send us an email to news@kunm.org. Tweet at us @KUNM News. Short break here, and we'll be right back.
Rather than add days to our spring pledge drive, we're asking you to help us close a $29,000 gap all in one day, today, or back to the Black Cyber Day. When you give a gift in any amount before 10 p.m., you automatically get two chances to win a brand new iPad Air. You don't need to donate to enter, but please consider helping us end this fiscal year with a balanced budget. Get the details and donate at KUNM.org.
Currents 2015. Experience interactive new media projections, installations, and amazing performances at the Santa Fe Rail Yard and other citywide venues from June 12th through June 28th. Currents 2015 is open to the public and everyone is invited. No tickets needed. Info at currentsnewmedia.org or on Facebook. A message from the tax-exempt National Endowment for the Arts, the City of Santa Fe, the Santa Fe Arts Commission, and New Mexico Arts.
This is KUNM 89.9, broadcasting from the University of New Mexico. We're back talking about abandoned uranium mines and uranium contamination on the Navajo Nation. We have a caller, Talia in Gallup, has information on transportation and storage. Hi, Talia, are you with us?
Yes.
Go right ahead.
Hi, good morning.
Thank you.
Yeah, I just wanted to clarify for listeners, as far as ways for the waste goes for radioactive material, there really is no repository anywhere in the United States. There's one that currently exists, and that's in White Mesa, or I'm sorry, Blanding, Utah, and that's the White Mesa Mill. And it's been shut down in the past because it's been at full capacity. And, you know, I also want to mention WIP with the leak, and that was also shut down currently. Recently. So there's all this waste that comes from all these abandoned mines, and there's nowhere to store it. That's a huge problem, and that also costs a lot of money, the transportation of radioactive materials between the communities. They use the railroads and they use the major freeways. So if there's an accident, God forbid, they really don't have any plans in place or any safeguards in place for emergency evacuations of the community members. And this is specifically for radioactive waste. So these are major concerns that I hear from different community members in the area. And there's really a lack of knowledge on the history of these uranium mines. A lot of folks don't even know that there's over 500 abandoned uranium mines on the Navajo Nation. The Gallup now has a cancer center, so that only shows that there are increasing health disparities, specifically the rise of cancer in the area. And Gallup, as a border town, a lot of folks come in off the res to get treatment here. I also want to talk about new proposed mining in the area. They're proposing new mining on Mount Taylor, which is considered a sacred site to the Navajo people and other tribes in both New Mexico and in Arizona. So when they desecrate our sacred sites with extraction, this has direct impacts on us as Native people, because this is where our holy entities live. These are where we send our prayers, and we have healing plants and pilgrimages that we take on these mountains. And so when our sacred sites are desecrated, this is also what increases other disparities within our community, such as alcoholism, diabetes, violence, domestic violence, and all of these things. So I wanted to highlight that for listeners because it's crucial, and we really need to also focus on new proposed mining because they're also mining uranium in the Grand Canyon right now.
Thanks,
and
Talia.
So this is also. I'm sorry.
No. I hear you.
I can go on, but yes, these are issues that we definitely need to talk about.
It sounds like it's an important issue for you, and thank you for your call, Clancy. Before we let you go, do you have a response for our caller about safeguards for further accidents as this waste is transported and things like that? Is that something that the EPA is paying attention to, or is that even your jurisdiction?
Well, we're very much concerned about transportation during cleanups. Just the truck traffic alone, some of these mines are millions of tons, they would cause tens of thousands of trucks to be on the road. So that's definitely a concern for us. One thing I do want to point out, though, before we go, is I know when we say radioactive waste, everyone thinks of plutonium, nuclear weapons, meltdowns of nuclear power plants, and not to minimize this at all, but it is a very much lower level of radiation. The kind of radiation that we're dealing with at mine sites would be unhealthy if you lived your life right on top of the mine. That's the level of exposure that you get from these versus, in a nuclear power plant, it may be a matter of days or hours. So it's a very low level of waste. It's still significant. It still has to be taken care of. But it's a different kind of thing than what people hear about. So transportation on the roads, while it's definitely a concern for the safety of the people that live nearby the roads, it's a different type of situation than what some of the callers might be thinking about when they think of transportation of radioactive waste.
Thanks a lot, Clancy. I appreciate you joining us, and best of luck to you as the cleanup continues.
Thank you.
We have another caller on the line, Jill from Albuquerque, with a question about lung cancer resources. Hi, Jill. Go right ahead.
Hi. Yes, hi. My question is, what is the legal recourse for a person who has lung cancer who worked in the mines? I have a family member who's fairly young and is suffering from lung cancer now. He worked in the mines at one time, and I'm just wondering if there are current lawsuits that he should know about, or any other information about what's happening now on that.
Jordan, are you aware of things that people that are suffering these health consequences can do?
There's what I know of, what's called the federal RECA program. So people who have worked in the mine are somewhat compensated, but it only goes up to a particular year. And there's no direct connection to people working in the mine and the cancers. We can make a high association. And so I think we need to conduct more studies to make a really strong case, like the caller mentioned, that people who are or have worked in the mines are experiencing cancers, lung cancers. We've seen it in the studies. But from my understanding, there's no direct compensation that people can pursue, unfortunately, except for the RECA, federal RECA bill. But again, that only reaches to a particular year, and there's ongoing conversations about how to extend those years so people who work post-71 are going to be compensated adequately.
Right. Well, cancer is a hard thing to prove, I guess, causality. But Jill, the caller, has a friend that has lung cancer from mining. Edith, you yourself have had a cancer issue because you were also a miner. I guess you can't point exactly to it. How many people do you guys know out on the reservation that have been living in proximity to mines that have experienced cancer or other health problems?
There are several that has gone that live near the mine. So there's a few that are there and right down the Rio Porco, Arroyo, people down all the way up to Gallup, they have some the people that pass away with cancer.
Right. Why is it so hard to draw that connection when it seems so obvious? You know, we're not doctors here, but if we know uranium can cause cancer and people around the uranium sites are getting cancer, why can't we prove that?
That's a great question, Ed. I mean, it would be really nice if we, again, can conduct more studies to make that really scientific case. And there just has not been a significant amount of studies done specifically around cancers to make that case.
And
there are some studies around kidney that some folks from the Southwest Information Center and UNM are conducting. Yet cancer is a little bit more difficult. And we have heard stories of people who have lost generations due to cancer rates or respiratory problems. So tell
us a little bit more about the studies that have taken place before your study. I mean, have people looked at this issue? Mr. Clancy from the EPA was saying it's a low-level radiation, so, you know, just walking through the area wouldn't cause problems necessarily. But has it raised the attention of a lot of medical researchers before your study?
From my research at this point, I would say that there isn't enough studies being done. There's called a birth cohort study that's being conducted around mothers who are giving birth to young children. They are monitoring those children. There was the DNA project that, again, around the kidney impacts that was conducted. And there's been some general research done around the kind of rates of Navajo workers, but there's not a significant amount of studies, scientific studies, that have been done for the people on the Navajo Nation, from my perspective. And I think it's hard, too, because one of the things we often forget is people who are victims of these kind of disasters are often marginalized already and experiencing high rates of poverty or just living to survive. And so when you compound that with health and stress and trying to decide whether you're going to move or not move, those are all also increases people's potential for different kind of health outcomes.
Right. We have a large population in this state that suffers from issues of poverty and health, but some of those have at least gotten state funding for studies, and I guess that hasn't happened here.
No, and there are conversations around trying to get a health study from a state perspective around a health profile in the Grants Mineral Belt, which would be a big first step to moving the conversation forward, to kind of figuring out the baseline so then we can conduct more studies to kind of put the direct connection between the different kind of diseases or stress levels or the cultural relevance of the land to people. And so then we can start to make the cases that we need to make.
Edith, Bertha, let's talk a little bit more about the cultural relevance of the land for you. And I know that a lot of people that have had to move from your community really want to move back and move back permanently. Why is it so important to you to live there when you know that there can be environmental problems that have happened in the past?
I was born there, and I wanted to stay there. And that's our playground, and that's where we live. And we want our kids to be there, or for our kids to be, and the grandkids, and to live there. We just want to hold on to the land that our elderlies had put us there.
What does it mean spiritually when this kind of pollution happens for the Navajo people? When the land is polluted like it was, I mean, does that have a spiritual significance, just the fact that the land has been spoiled?
Well, with all the prayers the elderlies had done and the cultural sacredness there, it's kind of like when they remove all those dirt and stuff, they took those. They kind of like erasing that whatever was done there. Mm-hmm. So we want, we rather have that not disturbed, because That's the way it used to be. Cause we, and then we have the plants there and the water. So that's all been ruined.
Edith, you wanted to say something?
Okay. Culturally, you know, as parents, they have young ones that are born. And from there, they took their umbilical cords and they bury them there where we live. And of course, we have people that have passed on that used to be, that are buried there already. And of course, like she said, we have plants and all these that we use in our spiritual rites, cultural rites. They're all there. And when they go to bury the umbilical cord in the ground, they say a prayer that that will always bring the child back to where she's from. That's the philosophy behind this.
What would you say is the most important thing that you want our listeners to understand about your experience? What should they take away from this?
That the human life is priceless, and we don't want this uranium being brought back up from the earth again, because these mining companies are ready to come back in, and we don't want that. And to keep this Navajo Nation ban in place to keep the miners away from the reservation. And to be more educated about how these uranium has affected the lives of the human beings that maybe have worked there or even lived there.
Well, Jordan, I do want to, we're almost out of time, but really quickly, I do want to get to the issue of continued uranium mining. Nothing's going on now, but there's a possibility in the future, isn't there? Can you kind of run down for us quickly what we're looking at in terms of uranium mining making a comeback in New Mexico?
Sure. Just real quick, there has been some efforts through the Navajo Nation Council delegate process to do in situ mining, which is a demonstration project. I think as Talia mentioned too, the Roca Honda mine, there's permitting process in place and being renewed. And so those are potential future mining activities that could take place in our area.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there. I do want to thank our guests, Edith Hood and Bertha Nez of the Redwater Pond Road community, Jordan Johnson of McKinley County Place Matters, Clancy Tinley. I want to thank him as well for joining us from EPA from California. If you missed part of this program or you want to hear it again, you can find it and past episodes on our website, KUNM.org. We're also podcasting the show on iTunes. Jefferson White was our engineer today. Kaveh Movahed manages our phones. Elaine Baumgartel is our executive producer. KUNM's Public Health New Mexico project is funded by the W.K. Kellogg Foundation. You can find out more online at publichealthnm.org. I'm Ed Williams. Thanks for listening.